Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. States are easing COVID-19 restrictions, returning millions of Americans to the workplace, but the coronavirus is still with us. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine acknowledged last week.
There's no guarantee that it can stay out of anywhere in Ohio. So I can't give that assurance at all. The virus is still here. It has not gone away.
And that means returning to work has its risks and stressors. Dr. Luan Fon is chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You know, it's one thing to go back to work amid all this, but it's another thing to go back after being stuck at home for 2 months. And there's a lot going on right now, right, in our heads.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There was a major transition to be at work and then be transitioning to work from home for the last few months, and then now a need perhaps to return back to work. So it brings about a multitude of emotions that vary across people. It's what we in the field believe as individual differences. I think there are, for some, people are excited to return back, to reengage in the workforce, and to reunite with their prior work colleagues, whereas for others, they're much more afraid and anxious about returning to that state and what needs to be in place for them to feel less anxious about it.
You know, and I saw a work survey that some people liked working at home more. They were more comfortable. They were more relaxed. I mean, it just goes to show that not everybody was happy in the first place.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think we didn't have this opportunity or this chance to look at our own personal productivity in the past. And when given this opportunity in the last few months, people, I think, took a different view in that they reassessed what their day-to-day productivity was like, how they liked their schedules, and what ultimately became more productive or just as productive as they were when they were physically in the office. And that allows for them to rethink perhaps with their team leaders and with their employers a possibility of maintaining this day at home as long as they're just as productive.
And returning to the office isn't going to be the same. I mean, there's still physical distancing. There's a whole other regimen of behaviors that we have to adopt.
Absolutely. I don't think that it's going to be back to business as usual. As we know, there's going to be this new normal at the workplace with many different kinds of precautions in place, things that we have really relied on in terms of person-to-person support in the past no longer are there, whether it's sort of in a handshake or a hug or convening over lunch at a communal area, or even meeting and talking around the provincial water cooler isn't going to be as possible as before. And then on top of that, I think that the pattern in the last decade plus was that people were going to be a little bit more interactive. You know, there were more walls being broken. People sort of were set up to be more interactive during the course of their workday, work more in groups, because the thought was that it was going to make them more creative, more productive, and that's going to be limited or at least curtailed a bit as well. So, I mean, there's a lot of adjustment that people have had to have, where the typical workplace sort of camaraderie is going to be affected as well.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about what's going on in your head as you return to the office, as you return to the workplace. My guest is Dr. Luan Fon. He is chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health at Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center. If you have a question or comment for him, or you know, want to get some advice about how to approach this new normal, whatever that means, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Then there is the fear of getting the virus going back to work. That's different. People are going to behave differently at work. How do you manage that kind of terrain right now?
You know, I think it's important to be transparent and open with each other, not only with co-workers, but between an employee and an employer. I think there's a lot of questions that people have in their minds as they begin to think about returning to the workplace. A colleague of mine, Dr. Eric Forrest, had said a little bit earlier this morning in a conference call, there's no such thing as too much communication when it comes to these kinds of things. So the more we can communicate with each other, validate each other's feelings and concerns, the better. Ultimately, there's a series of questions that most people will have that a team leader, a employer, boss needs to be aware of so that they can reassure their workers in terms of, you know, how will social distancing be practiced in the office? Or am I going to have to move to a different kind of office? Will my desk change in a certain way? How will I sort of operate in a team? What precautions are in place sort of on a health public health perspective in terms of keeping me physically distant, but also are there going to be health checks in terms of temperature checks and checking symptomatic of the potential infection? Mm-hmm. Will there be protective equipment provided for me? Do I have to use my own equipment? What if I run out? What if I forget to bring it in? Are there going to be new policies for hand sanitizers, hand hygiene that was a little bit more lax before that needs to be much more reinforced now? And then ultimately, it's going to be about, what if I or my fellow employee comes down with symptoms or becomes COVID-19? What's the aftermath of that? How will we react to that? Will we then go back to home to work? What's the period of quarantine and what is the protocol in place for that? And then ultimately, you know, these questions that you asked a little bit earlier, which is there a possibility that I can have some sort of hybrid schedule where mm-hmm. I spend some time at work physically, but then I can also work at home, like I've been used to these last few months?
We made a decision early on. We cut back a few, really not just like maybe one show a week, and we do an extra one on Friday now. But most of my staff is working from home. I'm wondering about what you've learned about how our attitudes toward productivity have changed with all of this.
Yeah, I think that there has been an attitude change. I mean, I can't speak for every workplace, but I think that every workplace needs to do a new survey and reassess the productivity of their team and whether there needs to be limitations on space and time. Sometimes we are always restricted by both space and time in our work because we do have to physically go to work and or set up meetings that are rigid in a time structure or even a duration structure. And sometimes that this now opens up now that we sort of have more ability to communicate by email, by other forms of video conferencing and conferencing by digital means. And I think that needs to be reassessed. Ultimately, I think that it opens up new possibilities that might not have been on the table before. For sure, you know, from our department and the way that we deliver mental health care has changed dramatically, you know, going from very little or much very minimal telehealth towards 100% telehealth. We now have to reset and figure out, hey, did it help patients more? Are there a subset of patients who actually not only prefer to do mental health visits by phone and by video? Will their ability to show up for an appointment be improved because they don't have the barriers of parking or driving that has always been sort of the kind of the a negative towards coming to an appointment on time or in a regular fashion? These things, even for a health professional, needs to be reconsidered. So I imagine these kinds of surveys and reassessments need to happen across multiple platforms and places of work.
Speaking of driving in traffic, my spouse returned to work, but he does not have the traffic problems that he usually does. So he comes home A, earlier, and B, more calm and relaxed. And I've noticed I don't have the same kind of traffic in the morning when I'm coming in. What about those sort of ancillary impacts on work and work experience, that stress of the rush hour?
No, I think that there's two elements to that, and I think you hit it right on the head. The first is this is that some people love to drive, but many people don't like it so much, especially as Columbus and the surrounding area gets a little bit more congested. We know that our drive to work and from work, especially around the 8 a.m., 4:35 p.m. time zone, has been a little bit more congested. And so there's an increased stress to driving, right? That's a stress that you bring to work in the first few minutes to an hour that you start, and then that's the stress you bring home as you're driving and rushing back to whatever you need to do from work to home. And then there's this element of for many of us who don't have the luxury of a 5 to 10 minute commute. It might be 20 minutes, it might be 40 minutes. And so there's like an hour that you gain back in potential productivity that you didn't have before. And that's with the assumption that we're focusing on driving, we're going to be careful about being safe on the road and not multitasking, you know, not being on the phone, not looking at texting, not being distracted. And so I think that those are sort of tangible and intangible benefits of relieving the traffic that is a part of our typical lives as our city gets busier and busier.
Then for people, what kind of things should employers look out for, supervisors, that kind of a thing, team leaders? Because not everybody wears it on their sleeve when they are stressed out and are having a hard time. What can people look for? What kind of questions can they ask?
Well, you know, I think that it's really important to acknowledge the anxieties and insecurities of an employee. It's really important to have a consistent, transparent, clear, and truthful message. As you know, and as everyone knows, the information that we're getting is ambiguous at best and maybe at worst, right? And with ambiguity, it just breeds more fear and anxiety, right? I mean, you know, you can have one set of recommendations from one public health official, and then it gets reversed or it gets modified by another one. So this ambiguity is problematic. So I think team leaders and supervisors and employers need to acknowledge that this is stressful for their employee. Perhaps set up an ability to have an anonymous, perhaps even confidential way for their team to give feedback. Like I said earlier, it's great to survey everyone and then simultaneously to check in periodically and have a platform so their team can actually share feelings and thoughts about their anxieties. And then ultimately, it's about maintaining you know, a public health guided, health driven, scientifically driven strategy for returning to work that makes sense for protecting each other health wise. And then I think lastly, it's really about promoting a culture of care and of safety to encourage everyone to look out for one another. Not everyone's going to have the exact same mental set when they return to work. And I think that we'll be better off if we work as a team. We've always been better off when we work as a team and look out for one another and make sure there isn't someone left behind or someone ignored or someone who's invalidated in terms of their feelings as they return.
Dr. Kayla Wamphan, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me.
Dr. Kayla Wamphan is the chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Dine-in restaurants are set to open soon in Ohio, but in the meantime, takeout and delivery orders have surged for millions of Americans following stay-at-home orders during the pandemic. But all takeout is not created equal when it comes to nutrition, according to Consumer Reports' latest edition. Tricia Calvo is Deputy Food and Health Editor at Consumer Reports. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
What factors did you consider when you assessed menus aligning with U.S. dietary guidelines?
Yeah, we didn't want to look at, you know, the opportunity to get a healthy meal is out there at many different kinds of restaurants, but so many of the restaurants define healthy as low calorie, and that's not the only thing you need to consider. So we really wanted to look at what we were calling the food environment. When you are in a restaurant or you're looking at their menu, like what are your real chances of getting a healthy meal? So are healthy dishes featured front and center and in a positive way? Do you have beverage choices that aren't high sugar sodas? Are you getting lots of choices of fruits and vegetables? Can you get whole grains? And the sodium and saturated fat levels, you know, are they under control or are they sky high? Again, that's something, you know, you see the calories on menu boards, but you don't see some of that other nutritional information.
And it should be the ease of accessing these kind of things, not have to ask about it. Like, I think Core Life ranked first in your listing. And Core Life Eatery, there's a couple in Columbus. I go to them, and it's so easy to see what your options are.
Exactly, and you know, almost anything you order off of a menu like that, you're gonna be making a good choice. You don't have to sit there and go, well, wait a minute, is this good for me or not? It sounds good for me, but I'm not 100% sure.
According to your study, nearly 8 in 10 Americans want to eat healthier. And I'm wondering, how does that really? Because I see them still lining up at McDonald's and Wendy's, kind of a thing.
I mean, that's true, except that, you know, people have good intentions, whether mm-hmm. they always follow through with them or not. You know, that's not always easy to tell. But I do think that, particularly this time with the pandemic, people are really zeroing in and focusing on healthful eating. I mean, I know everybody's been, you know, baking and, you know, everything like that. But I think, you know, as time goes on, people are understanding that there is a connection between nutrition and health, obviously between nutrition and chronic diseases like heart disease and diabetes, but also between your more immediate health. You know, a healthy diet supports your immune system.
One thing about a healthier menu is that it tends to cost more, or it seems like it costs more. Is that kind of a myth, or does it have to be that way?
I don't think it has to be that way. And, you know, it's hard to tell. I mean, certainly when you're shopping for yourself in a grocery store, healthy foods, you know, some of the healthiest foods are the least expensive. At restaurants, you know, it's controlled by so many different factors, including, you know, where the restaurant's located and their need to make a profit. But healthy foods really aren't all that expensive, and they don't need to be.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about how to order a healthy meal to go. My guest is Tricia Calvo. She is Deputy Food and Health Editor at Consumer Reports. If you have a good suggestion for some place to go and how to order healthy at a restaurant right now in the Central Ohio area, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wofosu.org. Now, when restaurants advertise menu offerings as healthier because they're gluten-free or made with no artificial ingredients, are there any hidden messages there? Should we lift up that stone and look under it? What should consumers do with that?
You know, a plate of gluten-free pasta isn't necessarily any healthier than a plate of regular pasta, and actually it can be less healthy. You know, so many of these buzzwords make it sound as though you're getting something that's incredibly good for you, but it's not always the case. So what you want to do when you're looking at, you're evaluating a meal choice is, you know, are there a lot of vegetables in the dish? Are there whole grains in the dish? Are you getting, you know, is it something that's going to be in a gloppy, fatty cheese sauce? You know, you really do want to look beyond sort of the buzzwords on the menus and look at the ingredients. Whole food ingredients are really what you're looking for.
Do you think that restaurants do a good job of describing what's in food?
I think that some restaurants do, and some sort of are a little smoke and mirrors in terms of the way that they portray the meals. I think that it really is up to the consumer to look. And unfortunately, you know, some of the restaurants are straightforward, and that's great. But unfortunately, sometimes the consumer has to do his or her own detective work and ask questions. You know, ask questions of, you know, the person who's taking your order on the phone or the waitress or waiter in the restaurant when we're all able to go back into restaurants. ask, you know, like, what's in this? Like, you know, can you leave the salt off? Can I have the sauce on the side? You know, a lot of choices, a lot of people are afraid of asking for customization, but most restaurants are absolutely happy to make you happy.
Olive Garden ranked low on your list despite a menu of salads and pasta. Why is that?
You know, the portions at Olive Garden are pretty high, and even though you know, salad can be unhealthy if you're loading it up with croutons and a lot of dressing and things like that. Also, you know, at Olive Garden, their unlimited breadsticks and never-ending pasta specials don't help either. It really is a portion control issue. You know, at Olive Garden, you can look at their tastes of Mediterranean items. They're more reasonable in calorie-saturated fat. Unfortunately, some of them are still high in sodium. Another option is to, you know, get a pasta dish and split it with a dining companion because the portions really are quite large.
Yeah, the article mentioned sodium as being a huge problem. And in the lower-ranked food chains particularly, why is there so much salt being used all the time?
I mean, it really is a problem not just in restaurant foods but in packaged foods, too. I think that salt is an inexpensive way to add flavor to foods, and people are, you know, companies and restaurants do use a lot of it. You know, again, when you're ordering, ask about the sodium content. Ask for things that tend to be high in sodium on the side, you know, that's dressings and cheese. Ask that they not add extra salt to your meal, and taste it before you add your own salt. Mm-hmm. A lot of people just automatically pick up the salt shaker and sprinkle it on before they even take a bite of the food. You might find that the food is perfectly seasoned without it.
Yeah, we don't keep a salt and pepper on our table. I mean, yeah. It's just not.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. I thought, you know, one of the things that kind of bugs me, I like a Wendy burger every once in a while,
mm-hmm.
but it drives me insane that you have to ask to not have the cheese or whatever it is on it. And everything comes with cheese now. Cheese on everything. And I love cheese, but it comes on the salads. You know, every house salads come with cheese now. A little sliver of Parmesan's one thing, but to have it covered in cheese, and you mentioned the croutons, but what's the deal with cheese and our obsession with it on everything?
Well, cheese is delicious. and I think that, you know, it's a way to add flavor. It's a way to, you know, make a meal look abundant. But it is high in calories and in saturated fat and sodium. So you do want to limit it. Now, you know, at a burger place, you almost always can get a plain burger.
You can. You order it, and the burger comes in. I think it's usually hotter, too.
Mm.
because they have they've got to go, wait, no cheese. No. So they got to go back and start over again. I love the idea about splitting courses. A lot of people typically do that. It's like everybody doesn't have to get their own thing. But there's another great the article offered 6 habits for healthier meals. And what, particularly when you're ordering, you recommend planning ahead. It sounds prosaic, but it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, if you're familiar with a restaurant's menu and you're not making the choice, like when you're starving or stressed and need to get, you know, something delivered to you right now, mm-hmm. you're going to have a better chance of, you know, really evaluating what they have to offer. And, you know, maybe you make a selection ahead of time and you can say, oh, well, they have a salmon dish here and that comes with a side of wild rice and broccoli. I think I'm gonna go with that. That sounds really good.
The another recommendation was get healthier of what you love.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
So if you love steak, for example, you know, ask for, you know, look for an option that is like a simple plain grilled steak. You know, if you're getting a restaurant meal, you know, the steak is probably going to be very well cooked. It's going to probably be a good quality of meat. You know, you don't need a lot of sauce and, you know, salt and seasoning or oil on top of it. Just ask for a very simple grilled steak. You know, steamed fish is better. Broiled is better than fried. Mm-hmm. You know, request sauce on the side so you only need to use a little bit. Those are things that can really help you eat things that feel a little bit more indulgent, you know, because we're not saying every single meal you eat at a restaurant has to be, you know, 100% perfect. You can make these little adjustments and just make it a little bit healthier, and that makes a difference.
And then probably the best one of all was be real about willpower.
Right.
I'm going to get the fries, but I'm only going to eat half of them.
Right.
Bologna.
Yeah, that often does not work. I think, you know, you can look at that as a, you know, sometimes when you're even looking at the menu, you're like, oh, those fries look so good. But really just look around the menu and see if there's something else that maybe will catch your eye. You know, perhaps there's something like a shrimp appetizer, or maybe there's some unusual salad that, I mean, you know, I know that they're not the same as French fries, but there might be something that does sound tasty to you. And another thing that you can do is you can decide before you go into the restaurant that you're going to do, you know, if you're going to have one thing that feels indulgent, like think about it. Like, do I want a dessert? Do I want French fries? Do I want a glass of wine or a cocktail? You know, think about those things and make the decision about what matters most to you before you even sit down or pick up the phone to order.
How well do you think, you know, a lot of restaurants have pared down their offerings for to-go during the pandemic.
Yeah.
What's your sense about how well they're doing at that? Are they giving us enough choices?
You know, I think it varies from restaurant to restaurant.
Of course,
and location
yeah.
to location. I think it's a necessity, but I believe that a lot of restaurants are still trying to keep some healthier items on the menu.
And also, do you think they make it easy enough? Say you want to get that steak dinner, but you don't need the baked potato. You just want the steak and the salad. Do you think they make it easy enough and give, you know, is it easy enough to do that in American, you know, eateries?
I think you can always ask. You know, and I think that's a great way of looking at it. You know, like, can you swap a salad for French fries? Could you have an extra helping of the broccoli instead of a baked potato? Could you ask them if they could, you know, put a fruit cup on instead of like a, you know, a side of pasta?
Uh-huh.
I think you're always better off asking than not. And one thing to do is, like, you can kind of, like, if you look around the menu, you might see, like, oh, you know, here the broccoli comes with this dish. I wonder if they can just swap it in.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they can, and sometimes they can't, but it never hurts to ask.
Well, Tricia Calvo, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Tricia Calvo is Deputy Food and Health Editor at Consumer Reports. We'll have a link to the article that I was talking about on our website at WOSU.org. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Heart health is a major concern for many Americans, but heart-healthy habits may fall by the wayside as we grapple with the stress and relative inactivity of the pandemic. And so we're talking about that and other health news today. Dr. John Swartzberg is the chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back with you, Ann.
Is it even a competition when it comes to medication versus behavior with heart health?
Well, it seems to be. There was really a disturbing analysis of people who were put on statins to improve their cholesterol. This was a study that looked at over 40,000 middle-aged people who initially were free of heart disease, but they needed to be on a statin. Because they were unable to lower their cholesterol otherwise. What was found was that when they went on that drug, an awful lot of them started to put on weight. And even some smokers didn't do as well as we had hoped in terms of quitting smoking. Some did, but not as many as we would have liked to have seen. And blood pressure control with the antihypertensive medications, the blood pressure control wasn't quite as well. So putting all those things together, it looked like when people went on statins, they thought, well, then I don't have to be so careful with the other things like weight, diet, maybe smoking, maybe my blood pressure. And that's really the wrong message.
Do you think that physicians aren't spending enough time talking with them about that?
Oh, I don't know. I suspect the answer is yes, given the way medicine is often practiced today.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors are crunched for time, and so they often don't have the time to really spend talking about prevention as opposed to taking care of the immediate problem. That's not to say that doctors don't want to. Certainly all the doctors that I know mm-hmm. really despair from not having enough time with their patients.
There is a lot of uncertainty around COVID right now, COVID-19 right now, and its effects on the heart. We just don't know a lot. What are you keeping your eyes and your ears peeled for as this unfolds?
Well, this whole issue with the heart and COVID has been very interesting. Initially, it was just some scattered reports, and then those reports became really almost a tidal wave of data to suggest that a lot of people who have serious COVID infection have heart problems attendant with it. We know that this what's called the receptor site for COVID, the site in our bodies that the virus uses to get inside of our cells and manufacture more viral particles, that receptor site called ACE2 is also found in the heart. And so we're seeing some patients with COVID directly damaging the wall of the heart or the muscle of the heart. And then we're seeing with COVID this tremendous inflammation that occurs, usually in the lungs, but that inflammation can translate itself to other organs, and the heart appears to be particularly susceptible to that. So cardiac damage or heart damage from COVID appears to occur at least in two ways and maybe more. One way by directly damaging the heart, another way by this tremendous inflammation that goes on the body in response to the virus.
And then there's the issue of the blood clotting, right?
There is the issue of the blood clotting. And again, initially this began with anecdotal reports, and now we see this all too commonly. And, you know, looking back at this, it's not so surprising because in terms of our biochemical evolution, if we were, let's say, attacked by a saber-toothed tiger, and the two ways we would die would one be by infection from the wound, mm-hmm. and the other would be by bleeding to death. So what triggers inflammation in our body also triggers clotting. So I think what we're seeing here, at least this is a going hypothesis, is that when we have this overwhelming inflammation in our body from COVID attacking usually our airways, that the overwhelming inflammation often triggers the clotting cascade. Now, there's a lot more we have to learn about this. Are certain people more predisposed to this or not? We just don't know yet. But there does clearly appear to be an association between the inflammatory effects of COVID and triggering the clotting cascade, so we form these blood clots.
I'm wondering, and you know, about what you're thinking about and what you're going to be looking for in terms of long-term public health issues with COVID-19.
Yes, I'm wondering about that too. As a matter of fact, one of my colleagues, a professor at UC Berkeley, who's a health economist, he and I are working right now on a paper to address that. The problem is we don't have long-term data because we've only been at this for about 5 months. Mm-hmm. But we're already starting to see some long-term concerns. We talked just before about heart damage. We're concerned that we're going to see people with chronic heart problems who didn't have heart problems in the past. We also talked about the blood clotting problems that can result in blood clots going to the lungs and compromising, sometimes permanently, our ability to exchange air. And then the blood clots, of course, can go to other parts of our body. And a common one we're seeing is that they can go to our brain, causing a stroke. And of course, that could result in permanent damage. So those are three areas, but there are actually more that we've been seeing now. We didn't think we'd see, but we're now seeing kidney damage from people with serious COVID infection. And we don't know what the long-term consequences to the kidneys will be. So those are just some of a few more examples of what COVID may be doing long-term. That is, once we're over this, let's say we have a vaccine, and once we no longer have to worry about getting COVID infection, the real worry is there's going to be an awful lot of people who have chronic damage from that initial insult. Now, I want to emphasize that I'm not talking about people who get a very mild case of COVID or are asymptomatically mm-hmm. infected. I'm talking about people who are ill and quite ill, usually winding up in the hospital and often on a ventilator.
When you're studying something like this, a disease, and preparing to look at the long-term effects, how long-term are we talking? How far out, particularly since COVID seems to mostly affect older people?
Well, again, we don't know. We only have 5 months of data. Mm-hmm. But the examples I was giving you suggest that these complications could be permanent, and that the individuals, even though they may live a normal lifespan, it may not be as normal. Mm. Those years may not be as normal as they would have been had they not had COVID.
Mm. Another reason to stop the spread.
Another reason to stop the spread, one of so very many, yes. And I think sometimes, I'm really glad you brought this topic up, because sometimes I think our leaders we talk about, let's get over this and get on with things. But we're going to be dealing with the consequences of COVID for a long time, not just the economic consequences, but certainly the health consequences.
I was talking to an historian yesterday, Yale University medical historian, and he was talking about the different reaction and response in Italy, where he happens to be doing research right now in Rome, and the United States, how in Italy, even though it was a horrible, it's lay waste to way too many people there. Everybody was on the same page once they did respond. All the different public health agencies, from the local governments to the national government, were all on the same page.
Yes, unfortunately, we have not seen that here. As a matter of fact, we've seen the direct opposite of that here, where every state is on its own, and often within each state, every county is on its own, and often within every county, it's every region is on its own. And that's not the way to deal with a pandemic, because, of course, the virus doesn't respect county borders or state mm-hmm. borders. We desperately need to approach this problem as a nation. And we, of course, need to approach this problem as a world. And the fact that the United States is progressively moving to going its own way vis-a-vis the world within the United States, it's every state on its own. And that's absolutely the wrong way to deal with this problem.
Then, of course, then we have the war of words between the president, China, and the World Health Organization. And I'm just thinking about, you know, it is a I'm just wondering about people who are in public health like you and your concerns about that going forward. Are we going to be elbowed out? Are we going to miss something? Are we not going to share something that could help other people elsewhere?
Well, what the president has done is abrogated the responsibility of the United States to be a world leader. And as opposed to being a world leader with this problem, we're going to be a world follower. And that's unfortunate because the United States in the past has been a wonderful leader for the World Health Organization and for world health in general. It's something that I think most Americans are very proud of what the United States has done over the last many decades in terms of trying to improve the health of everybody on this planet. And the idea that we're turning inward and turning against what the rest of the world is doing seems unwise at any time, and particularly disturbing during a pandemic.
My guest is Dr. John Swartzberg. He's chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Dr. Swartzberg, last year the Wellness Letter reported on a study looking at the effects of vitamin D and omega-3 supplements and found disappointing results. Earlier this month, you reported on some follow-up research. What's the difference?
Well, there's been some really interesting research with vitamin D. As I think most of your listeners know, there's been a vitamin D bandwagon going on for a good decade or so. A lot of excitement about what supplementation with vitamin D might mean. We've been particularly interested in a researcher from Harvard. Her research has been very well done, and has tried to address many of these issues with vitamin D. Most recently, we commented on a large analysis of cases that looked at vitamin D supplements to reduce whether or not they would reduce major cardiovascular events like heart attacks and strokes. And this was a very good analysis, and unfortunately, it showed that taking supplemental vitamin D did not reduce cardiovascular disease from deaths from cardiovascular disease. Mm. So that was disappointing. There was also another large analysis published in an oncology journal that looked at whether people who took vitamin D supplementation, whether they would have a lower risk of cancer deaths. And interestingly, this study did find a lower rate of cancer deaths. But it, interestingly, further, it didn't find a reduction in the overall incidence of cancer. So that the results were quite confusing. Now, I want to comment about both of these studies. They're what are called meta-analysis. That is, they're not new research, but they're combining multiple studies to try and get larger denominators to understand better what the phenomenon of vitamin D supplementation would be. So they're what are called observational studies, and that's what they all these looked at. And so these studies really can't prove what we call causality. That is, they can't prove that vitamin D didn't help or that with cardiovascular disease or did help with cancer deaths. They suggest a trend or they suggest that it's worth pursuing with better research. Bottom line, not a lot of support for vitamin D with preventing cardiovascular problems. This is one in a line of multiple studies, and skepticism about whether supplemental vitamin D would help prevent cancer.
Where do we get vitamin D from naturally?
Well, when we can be outside, we get it from the sun,
mm-hmm.
because the sun converts chemicals in our skin to vitamin D. So that's a great resource. The problem, of course, with getting a lot of sun on our skin is that it can lead to skin damage, aging skin, but more importantly, it can lead to skin cancers. So we don't want to get too much sun on our skin. Another source of vitamin D, the other source of vitamin D is going to be our diet. And vitamin D is not found in a lot of foods. So one has to pay particular attention to what they're eating to assure that they're getting enough. And fortunately, a lot of our foods that we consume are supplemented with vitamin D. For example, the classic example is milk. Milk products usually have vitamin D as a supplement to it. So if you pay attention to your diet and what you're eating, you can get enough vitamin D. For people, particularly during the winter, or people with darker skin where they're not going to be able to use sunlight as well to convert to vitamin D, sometimes a supplement may be necessary. But my preference is always to get your nutrition through diet as opposed to supplements.
There's different kind of vitamin D supplements, too. What's the there's like D3, there's different kinds. What's the diff?
Well, they both will work. The doses are very different.
Okay.
The body handles them differently, but they both will work. The most common one used is vitamin D3,
mm-hmm.
But vitamin D2 also works. Vitamin D4 has been reported to work, so I don't think that's a major issue. Again,
okay.
My preference would be to get your vitamins through diet.
Newsletter mentions that when paired with calcium, vitamin D might help maintain both bone health more. Is there anything there for us to learn?
Well, there have been some interesting studies on this, and frankly, they've been very mixed. There is not supportive data that taking vitamin D plus calcium is going to prevent osteoporosis. Where there is reasonable data is that people who are deficient in calcium in their diet, and deficient in vitamin D, they're more prone to developing weak bones. So I think the clear message is that people need to make certain they're getting an adequate amount of calcium and an adequate amount of vitamin D in their diet, not to make their bones necessarily stronger, but to prevent their bones from being weak.
It was good news for the avocado in the newsletter recently. I love avocado. What does it do for us?
Well, you know, I love them too. And so did a very well-known researcher from the University of Penn State University. And she looked at a study with people who were overweight and they were obese. And they had a high amount of the, quote, bad cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol. And she put them on three different diets. One was a fat moderate diet. Another one was a fat diet rich in what are called monosaturated fats that are considered to be healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was to eat an avocado a day. And what she found was that those people who ate the avocado a day actually had less what's called oxidized LDL, or the form of LDL that can damage our blood vessels. They had less than the other two groups. And previous research that she had done suggested that eating an avocado a day decreased the amount of these real small, dense LDL particles, which we feel are more dangerous. Put all together, it suggests that avocados are very high in fat, so be careful of the calories,
mm-hmm.
At least they are not heart unhealthy, and these two studies suggest maybe there's some cardiac benefits.
Yay, good news. Dr. John Swartzberg, thank you for your time today. As always, it was nice to hear from you again.
Thank you very much, Ann. Stay healthy.
You too. Dr. John Swartzberg is chair of the editorial board for the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.